gatto, pistoro matto.
Tomorori gatto, geek to me radio, da 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 da.
Welcome, 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 geeks and nerds, girls and boys, to a brand new edition of Geek to Me Radio. Today, we are joined by composer Raphael Reed, talking about his work scoring the movie Crisis, starring Gary Oldman on Amazon Prime. We'll then talk to Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan about their work on the movie The Parish, what it takes being actors, writers, producers, and wearing all those hats. All that and more. Stand by.
We're talking TV, comics and movies, and video games. Star Trek from Star Wars, we'll try to explain. There are 12 doctors, 4 Hogwarts houses, 1 ring rules and more. To be the greatest Pokemon master, you must catch them all. You must catch them all. Try to catch them all. Gotta catch.
And for those of you finding us for the first time, welcome to Geek to Me Radio, episode 206. I'm your host, James Enstall. For those longtime listeners who know all about us and have found us on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts or our main hub, anchor.fm, we thank you for subscribing and listening each week. Once again, we've got more stuff to get to than we have time to get to it, so let's get to it. Right now we're joined by composer Raphael Reed talking about his work scoring Crisis, a brand new movie coming out starring Gary Oldman. Raphael, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks so much for having me in your show.
Very glad to have you. This has got to be very exciting for you. If I'm not mistaken, you've obviously done other projects, but if I'm not mistaken, this is your first feature film, correct?
It is. Well, it's not my first feature film. It's my first Hollywood feature film. So I've done a couple in Montreal. But obviously, the scale of Crisis is like 100 times more than everything else I've done. I did some big shows, dude. Like, for example, there was a United Champions Leagues, who happened in 2014 in Portugal, where 150 million people watch it because it's the final of soccer over there, or football, how we say it.
Right.
But this is by far probably the most exciting project I've had the opportunity to work on.
And you've worked on other stuff. It's got to be very interesting working in all the different. You're doing music for a documentary like The Walrus and the Whistleblower, or you're doing a TV series like La Vie Parfait. When you're doing something like this, does it? As far as the different genres, like documentary, TV series, feature film, does it kind of work a different creative muscle in your brain, or is music music and you're just applying it to a different situation?
No, actually it does. It's pretty different. Well, I would say that TV shows, TV series and movies, they have some similar, there's something connecting them. That's for sure. And for example, you need to find the right mood, but at the same time, you have your own music personality. So you can be in kind of the same environment. Where it's very different is when you're doing live shows, because often live shows, the music needs to be all out. For example, one of the shows I did in China, we needed to do 100 minutes of music, and in those 100 minutes of music, you needed to create some lyrics. So it was kind of a musical.
Hmm.
So maybe if I would have done a musical in movies, I would say there's a similarity. But as compared to Crisis, for example, and pretty much all the other movies I've done and shows, obviously, first of all, the director is always the one driving the seat, and you're following his direction while putting some of your creativity. But you need to be careful of not overstating what the actors are saying. They're the main characters, and you are there. They're kind of the singers of your song, and that's where everything needs to revolve around them. As compared as a show where you have a song, where you have a chorus, a verse, and stuff like this, I feel music for movies much more organic in that sense, that it always evolves and follows the story.
And then there's obviously underlying themes. You've got incidental music, things like that. When you're putting together a huge Hollywood feature film, Where did you kind of start on the process? Was it just the collaboration with Nicholas Jarecki? Was it kind of starting with the sample you gave them to kind of pitch your idea and kind of build off of that? Kind of talk a little bit about creating the score for Crisis.
So yeah, actually it was pretty much the first song I made that kind of drove the movie. Well, obviously Nicolas had some ideas in mind. And in the past, he had worked with Cliff Martinez, who wasn't available at that time to work on the movie. And at the same time, he had shoot in Canada. So he wanted to maybe try somebody from Canada. So he had some interview. He met a lot of Canadian composers. And in the end, when I got the script, I tried out a song which became the main theme called I'm a Federal Agent on the soundtrack. And everybody kind of felt in love with that song, which for me, it was beautiful that everybody loved it because I was very unsure of what I was doing in the sense that I knew it was a beautiful song, but it was either he was going to love it or hate it and say, well, this guy is pretty weird. I'm not going that way. And I just tried it out and that's it. So I was really happy that he loved it and Cliff Martinez as well. And we all saw this song as the mother of all songs. So there was some elements in there that we decided that needed to be all throughout the score. But obviously, like I've just stated, a score evolving, characters evolving, a lot of emotion are around the score, and that's not the only one.
And I think it's interesting, too, one of the things when I was reading about the process you guys used, you had talks with Cliff and with Nicholas about wanting the movie to have its own music identity while avoiding cliches. What is exactly like in terms of music when I hadn't thought about it like that before, when in terms of music, when you're thinking about avoiding cliches, what were you guys kind of referring to when that element came up?
Okay. So I would say maybe cliche wasn't the word that Nicholas was using. He was mostly using being subtle, but in a way, Nicolas liked to have unicity and uniqueness in his movie. If you think about Arbitrage, it's not cliche in the sense that the movie, you don't have typical bad guys and typical good guys. And I feel that in the Crisis, you have a bit the same kind of treatment of the movie in the sense that, obviously there are some very moral, dubious people working into that movie, but there's a lot of authenticity. It could be a real life situation. So that being said, since you have this authentic portray of life, music needed to be careful of not overstating the actor's emotion. Mm. I'm going to give you an example. Orchestral, a lot of the time, can give you a... If I would have done, for example, a score like a Harry Potter score, obviously it doesn't make any sense there. It would not have worked. But even, for example, The Queen's Gambit, which is a beautiful score.
Yeah.
Same thing. Like if I would have been too far in the emotion, since there's a lot of nuance in the way that the actors are making their delivery, it would have been as if I was overstating what they were feeling. So it was a very fine line in finding just enough emotion so it doesn't come out flat, because music, it's if you don't give enough, it can make a movie bad. If you gave too much, it feels obvious. So it was very a fine dance between more emotion and less. And that's what I mean by not being too obvious.
And with it being kind of, it's a dramatic thriller, the movie Crisis, but it's talking about the tale of the impact opioids have across walks of life and people. That sounds dark, but you don't want the score to be just entirely dark and heavy either. So was it kind of, do you sit down and kind of see the movie as it is and you kind of take scene by scene? Okay, this one we can be a little lighter. We use different instrumentation. How do you kind of stay with a theme, but still not making it too heavy and dark? And how does different instrumentalists, instrumentations take part in that process?
First of all, it's because in a way, if I'm going to compare, for example, I know some people have been comparing Crisis so far with Traffic as being maybe an updated movie of Traffic in a way. I would say, for example, the difference with Traffic, it's drug lords. I personally don't see any positive outcome in this. In my case, in my view, drug war is lost. And I don't know what we're going to do with this. Opioids crisis is another ballpark in the sense that I feel we've kind of let it, put it under the rug a lot. Everybody knows about it, but nobody really does something about this. And I feel there's some positive possibilities. And I think you can see them in the movie as, for example, normal people doing big things like standing up against big pharma, stuff like this. And that's what I mean by not being completely dark. It needs to have some light. And some of the music goes that way. So when I did, I will say, for example, the lightness or the darkness evolves with the movie, obviously. But the main theme that I did when I did it is after reading the script is exactly how I felt. I felt there was a lot of darkness because of the opioid, but at the same time, I felt, wow, those guys are really trying to make a difference. This is very beautiful for me to have this under this thematic element in there. And so that main theme, the way that I've approached it, I didn't knew really what I was doing, to be honest. And a lot of the time I experiment and after I realize what I've done and I'm working with what I've done and trying to explore more into that area. And so the main theme, without knowing it, I did kind of music based on a two-note motif. So for those who knows music, it was an E minor and it was you using the B and the D note. And there was a lot of inner thematic element, if I could say, or inner counterpoint lines happening between them, but very minimalistic. And after doing this music, which is electro bass, I realized, wow, this have kind of a Steve Reich feeling. And Steve Reich is one of the guy in the minimalistic era with Philip Glass, obviously, which is one of the biggest name. But Reich, I always felt that this kind of neutral kind of music vibe where you it's as if you're in a dream state and you're just watching the train passes by. So that kind of particular feel was very interesting. And since, like I've said, became the main theme in Crisis. So every time this come for us, the way we saw this, it was normal guys standing against normal guys doing big things. That was the way we were saying this. And that's where most of the light comes, because obviously there's a lot of very dark moment in the score and the movie. And sometimes when something is dark, it needs to be dark.
And working on, this is, like we said, your first Hollywood feature film. What was the biggest thrill for you in this process as far as creating the music, working on this type of film with these caliber of people? What was the biggest thrill for you?
We'll pause right there, come back and take our next break. Talking more with Raphael Reed right after this. Please stand by.
Hi, this is Chris Sullivan, and you're listening to Geek to Me Radio.
Welcome back to Geek to Me Radio. I want to make sure you check out our premier sponsor, the City of St. Charles. That's the Greater St. Charles Convention and Visitors Bureau. They've been with us since the beginning. We launched this show back in 2016. They were the first people I approached for sponsors, and they were the first people to say, absolutely, let's do this. It's a beautiful place to visit. You've heard me talk about it. And of course, if you've heard me talk about it, you know I always mention the website, discoverstcharles.com. That's discoverstcharles.com. Go there, plan your trip. If you are in the St. Louis area, you probably passed by it, been out that way, but never really stopped to appreciate it, perhaps, because there's a lot of stuff to do in St. Louis, a lot of things to see. City of St. Charles should not be a thing that's overlooked, though. Gorgeous, gorgeous area. The historic buildings, the huge wide-open parks, the Katy Trail, where you can bike right up and down, all the wineries and the food shops they've got there in the downtown area. It's just a perfect place to visit. And if you're from out of town, hopefully we are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel with COVID. People are going to want to travel. People are want to get out of their house and go places they haven't been before. May I humbly recommend the City of St. Charles. Again, you can plan your trip on the website, find a place to stay, check out what you want to see kind of pregame and check, okay, well, we know we want to do this. Well, we know we're going to want to eat here one night. Check all that out on the website, discoverstcharles.com. Plan your trip, get information and more right there. As we always say, St. Charles offers you an historically good time. Very proud to have them as the official sponsors here on Geek to Me Radio. Before we took that last commercial break, we were talking with composer Raphael Reed about his work scoring the movie Crisis, starring Gary Oldman. And we asked him, for him, what was the biggest thrill of working on this film?
This is such a hard question in the sense that there was so many Trading Perfect. For example, just when I heard about the movie, just to have that chance to pitch in that movie, because as a French Canadian, it's very unusual for us to have this opportunity. And obviously, I think a lot of French Canadians love what Hollywood is doing. But the only way for us to have a chance to do a movie like this is to go live in Hollywood and maybe meet people and eventually blah, blah, blah. So when I heard about this, Nicolas Jarecki was doing the movie, Gary Oldman playing in this, I was like, okay, I need to do everything I can. If I don't get it, that's fine. But at least I'm doing everything I can to get it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the first thing. That was very exciting to start. And after, when I got the gig, eventually knowing that Cliff Martinez was going to be involved in advising us, mostly on a macro level, but that was great in itself because I'm a fan of his. He's a master in the electroacoustic genre. So I remember him, we had a phone conversation. He was like, well, telling me, well, I want to make sure like you don't feel bad about this. Like, I don't want to impose everything. And I was like, Cliff, man, I'm a fan of yours. Like, I'm going to take this as a masterclass. No worries with me in that. And after that, well, I'm going to LA for a 2 weeks period with spending time with Nick. That was amazing as well. I was in the studio of Cliff. We recorded a bit of Crystal Bache. I'm not using too much because I didn't want to be as... I didn't want to do a Cliff Martinez score, mm-hmm. but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And ending with the project, we went to Belgium to mix the whole project, was a great retreat to finish the movie. So I've been working on this movie for 6 months, and it has been probably the sixth most amazing month in my life. Even though I was always working, nothing else was happening in my life. My girlfriend was like, I never see you. I'm like, I know, but I have this movie to do and it's crazy and it's fun. And, you know.
Yeah, that's got to be. I mean, they say it's not work if you're enjoying it that much. So it wasn't really work for the past 6 months.
Yeah, well, I would say it's a mix of it because at the same time, like I really gave everything I had and were being on this 10 hours a day. Probably in retrospect, it could have been a bit more easy there and there. But anyway, yeah, a good mix.
And are you one of those people who can go watch a movie, like you mentioned a couple. You mentioned The Queen's Gambit, which is on Netflix now. It's blown up. Everyone loves it. Are you able to sit back and just kind of watch a TV series or a movie and divorce yourself, kind of switch off the composer part of your brain? Or are you hyper-focused on music when you're watching it? Does it kind of take away from the enjoyment a bit?
Honestly, I can't take away from my composer part. I'm always listening to music. If music's bad, for me, the movie is bad. It's a big issue for me, but I've been doing this for a long time. I've been composing for 12 years, so I've been actively listening to score for 12 years. And for me, it's part of the enjoyment. It's like, because sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm surprised by what's happening. When somebody tries something new, I'm always like, well, surprised. And when it's more traditional but well done, same thing. But when it's not well done to my taste, which is personal, I kind of get out of the movie. And yeah.
And we should mention too that the movie itself, Crisis, in theaters on February 26th, wherever theaters are open by you, on digital on demand March 5th. The soundtrack will be released on February 26th as well, and you can check that out. Do you have now that this is kind of under your belt, what's next for you?
Well, I have two things that's going to come out soon. Something in Abu Dhabi for the COVID. I've been approached throughout the end of the year. It's going to be a documentary on Netflix in that region of the world. I'm finishing my score here in Montreal for a very good director that I'm happy to work with, Yann and Glenn. And this is probably going to come out, I think, in March or April. And finally, I'm releasing an EP of my own music that's going to come out around 3 months. So a lot of stuff coming out soon. And Crisis, obviously, being the biggest of all the projects.
Very cool. And if people want to keep up with you online, is website, social media handles, where can people look for you?
Yeah, so I'm actually going to do some work in there. I haven't had time recently, but there's a website coming up in 2 weeks about, and I do have my Vimeo, my Bandcamp, and my Spotify, Rafael Reed, always and easy to find.
Perfect. This is great. I can't wait to see the movie and hear all the stuff you've lent to it. Rafael Reed, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks to you. It was great speaking to you, James.
And you as well.
My thanks once again to Rafael Reed for his time. I always love talking to composers. And if you have a chance, make sure you check out Crisis on Amazon Prime, starring Gary Oldman. All the music scored by Rafael Reed. Brilliant film. And you'll be listening to the music now, which is a good thing when you kick back to watch this show. We are going to take our next break, come back, and talk with Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan about their new movie, The Parish, and a few other things they've got brewing. So please stand by.
Hi, this is Chin Han from Ghost in the Shell, and you're listening to Geek to Me Radio.
We are back. Our next segment here on Geek to Me Radio. I'm your host, James Enstall. Thank you for joining us here on episode 206. Let's go to our next guests.
Right now we're joined by a pair that has a brand new movie, The Parish, coming out. Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan, actors, producers, writers, directors. They kind of wear a lot of hats. I thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
So everyone, I think horror movie is just one of those genres that I've never heard anyone say, that's not for me. It seems like it's always popular year round. Halloween, Valentine's Day are the two big times they come out, but there's never a bad time for horror. What drew you both to The Parish?
Oh, that's a really great question. Well, we work here in the Pacific Northwest, and we have a lot of great collaborators. We had worked with the writer, Todd Downing, previously. We'd produced a couple of short films with him, and Angela will tell you the story of his introduction of the script to her, because the connection was first made there. But as soon as Angela pitched the idea to me and wanted to bring me on as the director, not only did I know that Angela was a big, huge horror movie buff, so I couldn't wait to dive in that regard. But, you know, I grew up with Poltergeist and The Shining. God, I was just thinking of one other horror film, but it's suddenly escaping me. But I grew up loving the horror genre. I wouldn't call it my favorite genre currently, but, you know, working in the indie market or the indie filmmaker kind of lane, I've always ran with the assumption that if you have a small budget, the horror genre is a good place, a good pond to swim in as far as getting your movie made and distributed. And so that's what drew me to the project.
Yeah, for me, James, like David said, Todd Downing is a buddy of ours, and he and I go way back. We'd already done some short films with him, and then this feature, this is years ago now, he invited a bunch of actors over, and we would read his screenplays and give him feedback. And that night when we read The Parish, I took him aside. I said, Todd, we're making this movie someday. So flash forward years later, I said, hey, Dave and I are in a position. We would love to produce the film. David would love to direct. I would love to, you know, bring Liz to life. And Todd is such a great collaborative artist. We did some reworking. We made the daughter older. We changed some of the roles from male to female, just because that's a big component of who I am as a producer, mm-hmm. is making sure, you know, giving women great, strong, powerful roles. But unlike my partner in crime here, David, I was born and raised on horror films, whether my mom knew it or not. When she would go to work, my uncle Guido would babysit, and he and I would watch Nightmare on Elm Street, and Freddy was my jam. And I'm talking when I was like 7, 8 years old.
Wow.
And yeah, I got my hand on any paperback. I'm aging myself, but any paperback I could of Stephen King. And as I grew up and continued acting, because I started really young, I couldn't wait to be in my first horror film. So, you know, now to produce my own, it was just a dream come true. But what drew me to it when I read it so many years ago at Todd's house was that it's beyond just a horror film. It's also like a really powerful story about grief, that Liz is dealing with the grief of the loss of her husband. So to have like actual story and cool jumps and scares, I'm in.
I think that drew me to the story as well. It's in a lot of ways, it feels like a wonderful drama. A person who is running away from their grief and then suffering the consequences. I think thematically that appealed to me. And the fact that it's kind of set against a supernatural horror backdrop, you know, it's a ghost story. And so I think that those two worlds play very nicely. And now here we are.
Yeah.
And to your point, David, about how I for indie filmmakers, especially, horror has always been a very bankable genre, and it doesn't always require it. It's great if you have a budget where you can put in special effects and get an elaborate surrounding, but some of the best ones are story driven. And like you were, both were talking about The Parish, it's one of those, it kind of reminds me of El Orfanato, which is a beautiful ghost story. But if you've got that story, everything else is just kind of like a nice touch on the side. So to your point, yeah, I think story driven horror really is the best stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something that from the very beginning and even an interview we had earlier today, Todd would always mention The Conjuring.
Yes. Yes.
And one of the interviews we had, they mentioned The Conjuring after seeing our film. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't wait to tell Todd that. So it's true. It's where you get pulled into the characters and you feel or relate with them. But then it's also awesome to have all those other elements, those supernatural elements.
I'm glad you brought up Nightmare on Elm Street, because certainly Freddy Krueger, you know, when I was a kid, I loved that. I loved that first movie especially. And strangely enough, there's a character in our movie whose face kind of looks like Freddy's.
What?
Melted Jace. What are you talking about?
Oh,
you
don't Jace. Think,
yeah. Jace? No spoiler alert. But yeah, thinking about that now. I never thought about it until right in this moment.
You're right. So that's why I love him. My husband, even when he's crispy and fried up,
right.
It's really Angela.
Not your real life husband. That's
right,
me.
Not you.
I'm not crispy and fried up yet.
And with all the hats you guys wear, we mentioned you're acting in this. David, you're directing it. You guys do producing. You own your own company. It's got to be obviously it's a full-time job, but I'm saying wearing that many hats when you're doing all these different projects, are you able to at certain points divorce like the acting side of your brain from the directing side of your brain, from the writing side of the brain, or is it kind of an asset to have all those elements firing at the same time? And either one of you can take that and start.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot to juggle. And, you know, when you're thinking, when you're having to play producer and director at the same, I mean, directing in general for me, this was my first time kind of being the captain of this large of a vessel. And it's, I learned a lot of lessons. I think that we accomplished a lot, but there's a lot of things that I learned that I will definitely take to the next project. I think it'd be interesting to see how Angela is able to talk about this as an actor slash producer, because I know when I am an actor, it's great to just not worry about the production and just focus on the character and the scene. So I'd love to hear Angela talk about that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, James, you're an actor too. You know, we're always, as artists, I think we're constantly juggling so many things to stay creative. And early on in my career, and this was like in my 20s when I first lived in LA, I quickly became very indignant, or more indignant, that I was sick of waiting around for certain kinds of roles to drop in my lap.
Sure.
So I started producing my own work. And then flash forward when I met David 20 years ago. And for those listening who don't know, David and I are also married. So he's my partner in business, but also my partner in life. So when we met 20 years ago, we both immediately, you know, we were already doing theater, which we both love, but we wanted to get back into the film world. And for David, it was stepping into the film world for the first time. So we started producing our own stuff and we loved it. And we started with shorts, and then we got a few dozen shorts under our belt and thought, you know what, let's go to the features. And again, it was for me, I had to put a producer hat on because I love my agent. And we've now moved back to Seattle. I love Seattle, but people see me in a certain way or in certain kind of roles, which is fine. And there was just things that I was missing. And then when it came to horror or thrillers, I even more so knew I had all these scripts just, you know, an arm's length away from all my dear friends who write around us. And I thought, okay, here's a great opportunity. And being the producer and also the executive producer and the lead of the film and my husband's directing, it was hard. I'm not going to lie, but I love producing because not only does the OCD part of me want everything to be perfect, I'm also a fixer. And in this community, I'm known as Mama DeMarco for a reason. I try to make sure everybody's okay. So I'm not going to lie that there were days on set when I was trying to make sure everybody else was okay. And I was like, oh my God, I got to give myself some time. I'm about to dive into a scene. So David and I actually stayed in the key location, the house that you saw in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So when we would wrap a day out, I would early on in the earlier days of our 15 day shoot, I told David, like, hey, today was a little rough for me. I need you to take, you know, on a little bit more of this. Or our amazing AD, Micah Knapp, I said, hey, Micah, could you please try to, you know, focus on this, this, or this? So I could really just be an actor. And what was great for me and David to be director actor for the first time was also in those same evenings when we'd wrap a day, Dave and I would work on the scenes for the next day together. So, you know, that was kind of like a bonus that not only are we wearing all these hats, but being married, you know, for us to work together and really be an amazing partnership with the good and the bad. It was a blessing. But I also, for anyone listening who's a filmmaker, make sure you surround yourself with collaborative people who want to lift you up. Make sure you're not hiring pay-to-play crew or pay-to-play actors who just want that paycheck. And that's what we did. We had such amazing cast, such amazing crew. So even when we hit some hard days, everybody was like, what can we do to make this scene happen? Or what can we do to, you know, whatever hurdle we had, we all came together. So, yeah, it's definitely not for the meek.
Right. And David, I was looking over your IMDb page, and you were in such an underrated movie, Bad Samaritan. You got to play one of the cops in that with a great story, great cast. I'm involved with Legion M, which was one of the producers. And we had Dean Devlin on the show not that long ago, I guess, before the movie came out, talking about it. But what a great production that must have been to be a part of.
We shall pause once again for a commercial break. Come back and chat more with Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan. Please stand by.
Hi, this is Dean Devlin, director of Bad Samaritan, and you are listening to Geek to Me Radio.
Welcome back to Geek to Me Radio. Before we took that last commercial break, we were chatting with Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan, and we'd asked David specifically about, we've obviously had Bad Samaritan covered before when it came out, starring David Tennant, with Legion M producing it, and of course we had Dean Devlin, the director, on the show with us to talk about it. So we asked, obviously, David, how was it to work on Bad Samaritan?
It was really fun. You know, the Northwest actors, Seattle actors like myself, there's a little more production with larger budgets that happen down in Portland. So whenever we get a chance to audition for Portland shows, we're always super excited. And I remember I was a uniformed cop, and it was a pretty straightforward day. But just being on a large budget set and getting to work was amazing. And I remember it was a brutally cold day in a very kind of seedy neighborhood, and just gritty scene. But it was great. Dean was very nice. I never got to Leverage was filming in Portland kind of when I was first getting my start as an on-camera actor. And I auditioned for Leverage once or twice, but never made it on the show. But yeah, Dean was really great to work with, and quite a producer, really hustling, makes a lot of content. It's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. And did the both of you share a lot of credits, not necessarily the same episodes, but like talking about Grimm, which is kind of set in that Northwest area. It's just such a rich tapestry, the whole Northwest Seattle, Oregon area, to film these kind of things in, and almost lends itself to the type of stuff you're doing, like with The Parish.
Yes, for whatever reason, we haven't been able to get our government to increase the film incentive up here in Washington. They have like a 10-year plan right now, but I think it's $3.5 million per year, which is a fairly slim incentive package for filmmaking, because making movies on a certain kind of level, it's expensive. There's a lot of people that come together to make these, to make really good movies and episodic content and things like that. But Z Nation was here for five seasons. We've got kind of a really interesting landscape in Washington. If you go east of the mountains, everything looks a lot different. So you can create a lot of really amazing things here and get diversity of landscapes. And yeah, Z Nation was quite a ride. I was blessed to be on it a couple times, and Angela's on it as well.
And Grimm is actually out of Portland. So for Grimm, when we both auditioned, I remember, David booked first, and he got a great role, because for those who've watched Grimm, he actually got to morph. Like, you were like a snake guy.
A snake, yeah. Like
but you had a fancy name.
I think the name was it was Lausenschlange.
Yeah.
Which sounds German and kind of sexual and very, very, very interesting name. But yeah, it was cool.
I was not, I did not get to morph, which I was bummed. However, I was opposite the lead, David, but also, Sir Russell Hornsby, who I just have such a crush on and is just an incredible artist. And I got to film with them for the full day, and it was a great role. But Russell, like, even in between takes, like, we hung out and he talked to me about the industry and we talked about theater. That was right before he was going into the theatrical production of Fences with Denzel Washington, which then led to the movie. But he just made me feel so welcome, and that's those kind of times. It's kind of like how it was when we got Bill, who's this horror movie icon, in our movie The Parish, and we're working actors. I think a lot of people listening need to understand, although I completely fangirled out on Russell, that we're all just people. We're doing this for you guys. We're doing it because everyone wants to escape into a movie or a TV show, especially these past 11 months. I mean,
certainly,
you know, right? So there's the working actors that, even though Dave and I have been in, you know, over 80 films, both of us, a lot of people still don't know who we are, of course, but it's every city. There's so many actors who are doing this to tell stories and bring them to people. So Grimm, Z Nation, they're a blast. So it's always the indie world. I love it. I mean, my heart is in it. Just like with theater, I love it. But it is great when you can get on a big budget TV show or film, because you know, it always feels a little fancy.
You get the trailer. I mean, it's nice when you go to the trailer, they got the name on there for you. You're like,
certainly,
oh,
yeah.
Isn't this sweet? I'm not hanging out in my car and freezing. They got a little spot for me with heat and a toilet. I love it.
A little coffee
you
maker,
a
little
toilet?
Keurig
you
or something.
Do you have a toilet in your car?
I do not have a toilet in my car yet, although maybe.
Yeah, you got to upgrade to the new Kias. I hear they have a toilet in the back seat. It's great.
Oh, my God. Thank you, Kia.
Luxury. And awesome. We talked about, obviously, David directing The Parish. And, Angela, you had your directorial debut, I want to say, just a few years ago with Always. So did you both have similar experiences? Do you like the directing hat? Start with Angela and then go on to David.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. I'm loving this research, James. So without us turning this into a heartbreaking interview. So Always, first of all, was a short film. Mm-hmm. So a smaller endeavor, but not lesser by any means. I did write the script, and I also starred in it. A lot of the times, the reason why Dave and I started producing is, like I said, for us to be able to give ourselves work. But this was a story that was near and dear that I wasn't even planning on producing. I wasn't even creating it. I just wrote it for myself. And it was after our own personal loss that Dave and I were trying to have a child, and we had lost several. But then when we lost our third, which was our son who was furthest along, I went into early labor, and we lost Caleb. So that's where this film actually came from. And I asked David, you know, I wrote this story. And it wasn't like our story right on the nose for anyone who does want to see it. But it was about that. It was dedicated to him. It was about a couple and how they deal with grief and how people grieve differently. And a lot of the things in the film do not portray what Dave and I went through. I didn't turn into an alcoholic mess, and, you know, David didn't just leave me at home and go to work. But it's a very powerful story that touched a lot of people, and David agreed to do it. And I think for me, and we again brought in friends that we trusted, that we knew it was going to be a really fragile and emotionally challenging weekend. It was a long weekend. We did over a course of 4 days. And I put a budget together, and what was hard is I was directing myself. Mm. So for everyone out there who does that, God bless you. That is unbelievable and awesome. I don't want to do that again anytime soon. Thank God I had David, because there was even times that when it was a scene he was in alone, I was like, okay. And I like walked away to kind of get myself together after this emotional scene I shot. And he's like, Angela, I need you back here. You're my director. I was like, oh shit, I'm so sorry. You know? So it was definitely hard, but the DP was a dear friend of ours, and everybody was just making sure we were all taking care of each other. But for David, oh, and if anyone does want to see that, we did get distribution through the platform that Holly Shorts Film Festival festival built, which is the BitPick. So it's always is there and available if people do want to see it. But David, when he said he wanted to direct, I'll just say briefly, like, oh my God, actors line up to work with this man. And yes, I'm his wife, but I'm telling you, he was like this with everyone, from Bill to Sanaa Lutsis to Jin to Jonathan to Obadiah to myself. Whether you were an extra, one of our day players, or one of our leads, or me, he's just such an actor's director. But I'll let him speak to that.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my thing, coming from the world of being an actor or teaching acting. It's very easy for me to talk to actors about enriching their performance or giving notes or asking for things that I think will help the story. But that is a lot different from having a vision or an idea of how to make the themes really come to the front of the picture, or to execute a vision for the story, which are definitely my the weaker aspects of my directing. So certainly I needed to create or be around a team of filmmakers who had experience, because I was going to lean on them for this and that. And I think that moving forward, certainly if I do it again, I'm going to definitely make more time for pre-production, because we did have a couple things kind of shift while we were before we started filming. A few things happened. There were a few wrenches that made pre-production. We just didn't have as much time as we wanted. And I think that if we had a little more time, it would have been a little smoother. I mean, at the end of the day, just completing the thing is a lot to be proud of, because I've been, like, you know, as an actor, as a filmmaker who has more experience acting, I've been in a lot of things that never made it to the audience.
Right.
Yeah. Whether it just, you know, it just never gets finished, or it gets finished but it's just not worth sharing, or whatever. So the fact that we were able to get it into the can, get it through post, and get distribution with a distributor that actually, if I may be frank, seems decent, because I don't know if I can count how much can I swear on this show.
If you could try to keep it so the FCC won't get too upset, that'd be great.
All right, fine. While we were navigating through the waters of trying to find a distributor, I guess I'm just going to say to other filmmakers, tread carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Have an attorney, an entertainment attorney on your side.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of paperwork and stuff and contracts. And we narrowly escaped a couple of crappy deals. Mm-hmm. And we're very grateful to be where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's definitely something to keep in mind, I think, for going forward. Wow.
Well, and something too, James, it was interesting because not only is the producers, but I told David, I said, hey, I'll kind of, you know, be the lead here on these phone calls in the early negotiations, because a lot of people, we went to an equivalent of AFM basically here in Seattle. Shout out to our friend Ben Andrews, who creates this really amazing, it's called the Seattle Film Summit. And there's like an AFM, for lack of a better, there's all these distributors who come, all these financiers, investors, and there's all these other things, workshops, panels, whatnot. So we did pitch the film there, and that's where we got a lot of the people that were interested, and then also just buzz, people reached out to us. I am, again, like David said, I'll bite my tongue on what to call them. It is shocking to me how many, they were all gents. There was only one that was a woman who I immediately got excited about, but that even led to be a really shady deal. But the things that just like Harvey Weinstein level kind of stuff was happening. And I can hold my own because I lived in LA, you know, on my own in my 20s and the 90s. And that was like Baywatch kind of time. So I was kind of used to people objectifying, let's say. But you wouldn't believe how many of them are like, you know, you seem pretty. I'm sure we can give you a good contract.
Yikes.
You know, yeah. I mean, it was just like, wow, what does that have to do with anything? you're the executive producer. That's cute.
Ugh.
Or the one that happened more often was they hear my voice and said, oh, is David there? We wanted to talk to, you know, the producer. I was like, well, no, you are. That's me.
Well, didn't one guy tell you who's like, oh, good, you've been around the block a bit, so I'm not popping your cherry.
Yes.
I was like, what? People still talk like this? What is this, 1970?
Yeah, it was brutal. So I would, I'll just reiterate what David said. We love our lawyer. Steve Edmondson is just like, oh, my goodness. You got to have a lawyer that you trust. It's worth the money because it will end up getting you money down the road.
Yeah, no kidding. Man, it's sad to see that there. I mean, obviously, every industry has its seedy underbelly. But I was kind of, you know, you always hope that Hollywood's cleaning itself up somewhat after all the stuff we've seen in the news lately. So sad to hear that that was part of your guys' experience.
We're going to take a quick pause for our next commercial break. Before we take that commercial break, though, since we were talking Bad Samaritan earlier, I want to remind you the best place to see Bad Samaritan when it was out, any movie when it's currently out, Marcus Theaters, marcustheaters.com. That's Marcus Theaters and Movie Tavern. Great place to go see a movie. The new Tom and Jerry movie is out in theaters. There's a whole bunch of movies coming out. It's spring. Places are starting to open up. Marcus Theaters Movie Tavern have been open for a while. I saw my first post-COVID, not that we're past COVID, but once things start to open back up again, post-COVID movie, we saw Tenet in a Marcus Theaters, and they went above and beyond. Super, super thorough job of cleaning everything, make sure everything was sanitized. They've got the kick plates on the door, so you can open the door with your foot, and you have to touch the handles. You can download the Marcus Theaters app, so you can actually order your tickets, and you can even order your concessions ahead of time. So here's the movie I'm going to see, here's the concessions I want, so have them ready as I arrive for this particular movie starting at this time, making it a more contactless experience. They've got limited capacity in the theaters themselves. I went and saw New Mutants a couple weeks later when it was out, and everyone was safe. Everyone's wearing their masks in the theaters. If you obviously pop it down when you're taking a drink of your soda, you're eating your popcorn, nothing like movie theater popcorn. But it's just a fantastic experience. I miss going to see the movies. I'm glad they're back. And you need to get out and support these theaters, because if anything happens, if it goes away again, you're going to be, oh, I wish I'd gotten out and seen a movie in a movie theater. Don't wait. Marcus Theaters Movie Tavern. Go to the website, marcustheaters.com. Find the location closest to you or download the app, and you can do it that way as well. Marcus Theaters, the official sponsor of Geek to Me Radio when it comes to all things movies. We're going to take that break, come right back, and finish our conversation with Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan. Please stand by.
Hello, this is Kari Payton, King Ezekiel from The Walking Dead, and I encourage everyone to listen to Geek to Me. It's a lovely program. Would I ever steer you wrong?
Welcome back for our final segment here on the 206th episode of Geek to Me Radio, chatting the rest of this time with Angela DeMarco and David S. Hogan. We were kind of talking about how things are changing in Hollywood, kind of discussing the way things are in Hollywood, and ask them what else they have planned.
I think things are certainly trending in a much better direction, but yeah, it can be kind of a brutal world out here for us small time filmmakers.
Yeah, but then we have this amazing duo, Adam and John of Sifino Ventures, who are buyer's reps, who reached out to us. And thank goodness we were jumping ship off of one of the red flag offers that we were hoping was going to be the one. And they were the ones who connected us with Uncorked Entertainment. And they've just been awesome. It's been so awesome.
So if you're listening to this right now, make sure, with all the stuff they've gone through, you definitely need to get out and support this film, people. So it's on, as we said, March 16th. It's on DVD and digital. You can check out The Parish. Once The Parish, it gets out there, people are watching it, what else can they look for from the two of you?
Well, what's next? We have a few more days of principal photography for the horror comedy Mr. Bleachers, which we are producing with director Tim Carpenter. Mm-hmm. And I play... did he pronounce it the titular role? That also sounds titillating. I play the title role, Mr. Bleachers, who is
a head to toe bleached white entity.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of, you'll have to, we have a strangely enough, there's already kind of a teaser trailer because there was a good reason at the time to create it, but then the pandemic hit, so we've had to kind of pump the brakes a bit, but we really love the script. We love the collaboration. It's got cult classic written all over it.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that I get to play this very wild horror figure that's at the center of this movie, I am just having the time of my life as an actor.
Yeah, it's Tim Carpenter, our buddy, again, a script that he pitched to us. We'd already done a bunch of shorts with him, and I again said, hey, could this role be a lady and this role be a lady? He's like, sure. So what was a father role was turned into a really badass mom role, which is my role, where I really tapped into my own mom, who was just a really cool single mom growing up. And it's like David said, there's our lead character, Billy, who is kind of fighting internal struggle, and Mr. Bleachers appears when he's having troubles as a little kid.
Bullies. He's getting bullied.
Yeah. His mom is in a domestic violence situation. And Mr. Bleachers is like, hey, let me fix it, Billy. We can just kill them all.
Can I come into the rescue? Is he an alter ego? Oh. Is Billy manifesting and doing these murders himself? It's all you'll have to watch the movie to find out. But it's wonderful. It's definitely going to sit firmly in that horror genre. But we're exploring some other really important themes like bullying and mental health. And it's exciting and it's lovely. It's going to come up. Well, hopefully it'll be coming out next year. And riding on the coattails of our success with The Parish. It feels good to have two movies that we've produced and feeling really good about them.
And where can people keep up with the two of you? Online, website for future projects, social media handles and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I think the easiest one to promote is our production company / education outfit, and that is all over the internet at Mighty Tripod. So we're on Twitter, Instagram,
TikTok,
which is certainly an interesting new adventure, and on Facebook. You can find me. I'm all over social media as well, either David S. Hogan or on Twitter, because somebody already had it. On Twitter, I'm David Scott Hogan.
And for me, I'm I'm Angela DiMarco. That's DIMARCO. And on all the platforms. And we also have our Parish accounts, which are on Twitter. And that's at
The Parish Movie.
But if you guys want to pre-order the film, it's on Amazon for pre-order or in stores March 16th.
Very exciting. This is great. Thank you so much for your time. We have Angela DiMarco, David S. Hogan. It's been great to talk to you. Continued success to you both.
Thank you so much, James.
That's going to do it for us. Another show in the books. My thanks once again to composer Raphael Reed and actors, writers, directors Angela DiMarco and David S. Hogan. Thanks, as always, to Joey V for making this show sound as good as it does and keeping us going every week. Until next week, my friends.
It's not in the way you watch I sound be. It's not in the way you watch the flash. It's not in the way you love Scotty Young Art. It's not in the way you play Mario Kart. It's not in the way you look when you make Game of Thrones references. That's a show. This is Geek to Me Radio. That's a show.
Thank you, Planet Earth. Good night.
Hi, this is James Enstall, host of Geek to Me Radio, and in honor of my favorite Themyscirian, I've decided to become an Amazon warrior.
Hera, give me strength.
The next time you want to buy something from Amazon, go to geektomeradio.com first and click on our Amazon affiliate link. Simply shop like you normally would, and when you check out, a small percentage will go towards supporting the show. So remember, the next time you want to search Amazon for the latest